everyone, and welcome to Longevity Post Podcast number 6. I'm your host, Scott Chiveri. Joining me, as always, is Immortal Hair himself, Brian Simonis. Brian, what's going on?
Terrific. Hope you're having a nice day.
I am, thank you. Our inspirational quote of the day is, "The journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step." Lao Tzu. All right, Brian, so this is podcast number 6, and in our last podcast, this is part 2 of 2 on oral pathology. So in our last podcast, we covered cavitations, we covered root canals, we covered dental implants, we talked about oil pulling, and we talked about some resources for folks, drhuggins.com and iaomt.org. to find a biological dentist that understands kind of the concepts that we're talking about. So in part 2 of 2, we want to keep going with some dental health related matters. So what's the first one you want to talk about?
Well, one thing we didn't really get into so much, if at all, was the gum disease. So I think you were saying off the record that, you know, this is probably one of the most basic things that people look at for their oral health. So we should definitely mention this. You know, in fact, my own personal story, back in the early 90s, in fact, when my hair was really just being hit hard, not just was my breath atrocious, but also, you know, my gum health was just deteriorating. And I thought there's got to be some connection here. So I think the first thing we should talk about is this whole, your basic gum health. What's the health of your gums and what can we do about it? So, I can start off if you'd like.
Okay, so do we need to define gum disease, or is it just so when I think of gum disease, I think of when I've gone to the dentist and they tell me that I have pockets. Is that pockets around my teeth? Is that what you're referring to, or periodontal disease? Is that the same thing?
Well, usually what you have are things like gingivitis, so you have some sort of itis is an inflammation if you think about it that way. So that's usually the initial stages, So what you're going to have usually is you're going to have gums that are maybe discolored. They're not going to be pink and vibrant. They're going to be proton rich, which really means they're lacking electrons. And they're just going to feel unhealthy. You're going to actually feel something. You also might see some recession. They're going to start pushing back and receding. Okay. So that's a very
receding gums, which I think is part of the pocket issue. Have you been to the dentist when they stick the thing down and they measure how many millimeters the pockets are and they tell you, how bad it is? And then what about if you floss and it bleeds? That's typically a sign of unhealthy gums.
Well, it seems to be quite common, even if people brush your teeth, and then maybe they take a break from that. I often sort of think from a caveman mentality, which is, did cavemen brush their teeth? And, how do they get along without it? My own personal belief in the whole formation of cavities and healthy gums is a nutritional perspective. Based on the research literature I have read, it's a systemic condition. It's not a toothpaste deficiency. It's not a floss deficiency. And I'm just thinking from a perspective in animals. Do animals brush their teeth? Do they floss? And we can get into that later if you want to explore that avenue. But something I've just been inherently skeptical of, and the more I've learned about how oral pathology or gum and teeth health really work, look at the natives. Prior to the civilization of food, the processing of food, the adulteration of food, how do they have amazing teeth? Never needed a single dental visit in their life, and they died with perfect intact teeth, never braces or anything. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, right? Because it's interesting. There's so many things that we just take for granted because it's all that we know, right? Like, the time you're a small child, you're taught you have to brush your teeth, you have to floss, go brush your teeth. If you don't, your teeth are going to fall out. You're going to get cavities. I mean, it's ingrained in us from the very beginning. But if you actually take a step back and look at it through an evolutionary lens, it doesn't seem to hold muster. There has to be something else going on, right? Like, it's not, like you said, it's not a toothpaste deficiency. So what is it? So what
Okay,
is it? Can it get
so
into what why are people having what are some of the root causes of gum disease or cavities or whatever the case may be?
really, I'm going to take a huge, huge step back on this one, just to sort of allow the listeners to just sort of think about it in this on a different environment. Think about what we were doing hundreds of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years ago, depending on your religion. Well, we were usually not wearing shoes. We were actually in bare feet a lot of the time. And when you're touching the earth with your bare feet, you're actually doing a form of grounding, which you're literally receiving electrons from the earth, which means you're really getting a complete neutralization of some inflammation. You're also de-stressing your body. Stress has an enormous impact over the formation of cavities, probably not a surprise. Another thing is you were getting sunshine. We weren't indoors in our offices hiding and shielding from the sun. We were getting active sunshine. We were also not putting on suntan lotion, and we were also not washing ourselves constantly in the bathtub, which is preventing the natural oils or sebum to take or collect that ultraviolet B radiation and allow it to absorb into the vitamin D, which is necessary for the formation of substances which help form calcium and other substances to make proper teeth and form dental arches that are not going to malform or change the appearance of our face or our nostrils or jawbones for that matter. And then we incorporated whole foods that were, were rich in magnesium and phosphorus and vitamin K2 and other things that were allowing the full body of the enzyme systems that allow a cavity-free existence. So unfortunately, today we live in a processed society, which we go to the market, we buy processed food that do not contain substances like vitamin K2, which are really, really important. Or we're not out there in the sun, we're not walking on bare feet and grounding and de-stressing, and we're in offices, we're in other environments under tight deadlines, increasing our stress. So that's one thing I wanted to start off right off the get-go.
Okay, so you mentioned a lot there. So I've definitely heard of grounding or earthing, as it's called. I've experimented with it. I've experimented with grounding at night when I sleep, and I did personally. I noticed that I slept better when I did it. And then you also mentioned vitamins D, vitamin K2. So I guess since we kind of went down that path, can we continue down that path? From a supplement perspective or diet perspective, what do you recommend? Obviously, so we mentioned D and K2 already. Anything else?
Yeah, so there's also vitamin A as well. So there's an interesting thing that happens when you take, let's say for imagine, just for imagine for a moment that you are supplementing with some vitamin D, but you're not getting enough vitamin A. That could create a bit of an imbalance. Or if you're doing the other way around, where you're taking lots of an A, a lot of vitamin A, but not enough vitamin D, it can also upset the balance. So the body's going to start screaming for certain substances, specifically vitamin K2, that activates an important system that regulates what calcium does. Does it go into your teeth? Does it fortify your bone development? Or does it wind up in soft tissue and cause some other problems? They call it a calcium paradox. So, and really, to get your teeth and your gums healthy, they really need to be nourished properly. And sadly, today we're not always eating the best diets, and we're under a lot of deluge of stress. So now the gums also are important things. So
So,
perhaps we can discuss a little bit about that as well.
okay, so Brian, so you mentioned three things: vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin K2. Those things I believe have come up in the past. From a supplement perspective, now I can tell the folks what I do specifically, but from a supplement perspective, should I just take a vitamin A supplement, some beta carotene, and call it a day? Is that gonna be good enough?
That's a great question. So, they, meaning scientists, researchers, often and too frequently study nutrients in isolation. And this is a bit of a problem because we're really designed to have a complement of different fat soluble substances that generally work together. So, if you think of things like vitamin A, which is best in forms from animals because it forms all trans retinoic acid, vitamin A from plants are the alpha trans carotenes and so forth, which are not always 100% adaptable or convertible into a form that your body completely takes advantage of. Because vitamin A affects the thyroid, it affects energy metabolism, it affects the whole retinoid system. That also works with vitamin D and vitamin K. So vitamin A, vitamin D, and vitamin K all go through what's called an RXR receptor, which really creates a system-wide effect on your body's physiology. One thing I should make mention is that vitamin K2 actually affects the mineralization of bone, particularly in the teeth, and it can actually determine the direction of what's called the dentinal fluid transport system. Basically, what that means is the way minerals are formed in your teeth, they begin from your bloodstream, they go into the pulp chamber through the dentin, through the enamel. This is the proper direction of the dentinal fluid flow system, which was discovered in 1999 by a few scientists. This is the origin of how tooth decay either ends or starts. It can begin if the dentinal fluid transport goes backwards. So what you do not want happening is if you are getting the fluid flow goes into your enamel through the dentin, through the pulp chamber, and basically deconstructs the tooth. That's what you do not want. And what happens to do that? Well, it could be stress. It could be spiking in insulin, which could sort of freeze or halt something called the parotid gland, which is governed through the hypothalamus. The parotid gland is on the sides of your face, and that sort of determines or controls or drives the fluid flow from out of your bloodstream into the pulp chamber, through the dentin, through the enamel to form that structure of the tooth. So things like vitamin A, vitamin D, and vitamin K are all play a role in that mineralization process.
Okay, and vitamin A specifically from animal sources, so something like maybe desiccated liver, I think it's a pretty good source of vitamin A. So this is what I take. I do take I take a product called Green Pastures Fermented Cod Liver Oil and High Vitamin Butter Oil combo, which is supposed to be naturally high in vitamin A, vitamin D, and the butter oil is high in vitamin K2. I also take desiccated liver, and then I also take Decalcify, which has vitamin K2, the MK4, and MK7. Now, actually, that's another question that I have. So there are different types of K2. Do you know?
Yes. So I'll talk about myself just on this. By the way, I want to mention that anyone who leans towards vegetarian or veganism, that's fine. If they take a form of vitamin A called retinal palmitate, what they use usually palm oil, and they convert it into a form that's readily convertible into L-trans-retinoic acid. So they can take retinal palmitate and also enjoy the benefits of a full functioning vitamin A, because half the population cannot adequately convert vegetarian vitamin A into all four, I'm sorry for my English here today, the L-trans-retinoic acid, which has full functionality. So to answer your
Okay,
question,
Brian,
Scott,
don't feel bad because I don't think most of the listeners could just pronounce whatever you just
okay,
said.
I understand. All right, so vitamin K comes in several forms. The way we usually look at it is vitamin K7, which is decalcified, that is derived from natto, and natto is this delicacy that's frequently eaten in Asian countries. And people, it's a delicacy. It requires an acquired taste. I personally don't like it at all.
I think it's
But
disgusting.
yeah, and a lot of people also agree with that. So it is a form, and it is available in a supplement. So that's one thing to consider. Another thing is there's also vitamin K4, known as menaquinone 4, and this is something that has. It's usually derived from animal products. You'd have to eat an awful lot of the animal products, and more importantly, you'd have to eat an amount of the organ meats, which a lot of people are very, they're not very excited about organ meats. Goose liver paste is probably one of the richest sources of vitamin K, 4, by the way, if you're interested in getting it from food sources, but it's just not my style personally. So I'd rather supplement. And there are distinctive advantages of vitamin K4 versus vitamin K7, or I should say, I'm sorry, MK4 versus MK7. These are just different menaquinones, part of the whole vitamin K2 family. And there are actually other forms of vitamin K2 as well. You can get some from certain types of aged cheeses or perhaps other foods. But suffice to say, the most common in supplement forms is MK7 and MK4.
Got it. Got it. Okay. So, all right. So we kind of branched off real quick and we talked about the key supplements for healthy oral health. So, and you touched a little bit on gum disease. Do you wanna move over into amalgams? I mean, I think most people are pretty familiar with the issues with amalgams, but we should discuss it because it is pretty common.
Yeah, amalgams is basically another way of saying either silver amalgams or simply put mercury. So mercury, as you know, is it's the most toxic non-radioactive substance on the planet. So it's pretty toxic and it destroys enzymes. It destroys thousands of enzymes that are considered essential for full health. And when you place mercury into the mouth of a rat. They love to do experiments on rats. They found that thyroid receives a significant amount of mercury 4 minutes later. So that makes an impact. And the thyroid, basically just starts taking a hit. Now, it's not just the thyroid that takes a hit, it might be other organ systems that take a hit. Every time you chew or masticate food, you're releasing 15,000 times the amount of mercury vapor that you would when you're not chewing or drinking hot liquids. So that's something to consider as well. And the effect that mercury has on an individual can be profound. It's a great imitator, meaning that it does so many different things, no one can really completely put a predictable handle on it. So it could affect your mood, it could affect your ability to focus, it could affect your ability to sleep. It's really everywhere. And so I've seen amazing, I would say even borderline miraculous health transformations when people would do a full form of mercury rescue, where they would do all the proper safety precautions in removing these mercury amalgams. By the way, if it's done improperly, you can also take a serious health, you could go backwards really, really badly.
Right, so I'll give my own 2 cents on the amalgam. So I did have my metal amalgams removed about 1.5 years ago, and I went to a biological dentist here in Phoenix, and it was really amazing to see the precautions they took in removing these tiny little metal, which are supposedly safe, at least according to the American Dental Association, right? Fillings. Both the dentist and the dental hygienist wore these Darth Vader type masks, so it's to protect them from any fumes that could possibly, they could breathe in. There was this long elephant trunk, which is this long tube that was vented outside that they put right up to my face as they were in there digging them out, again to vent the fumes outside so they wouldn't fill up the office. They put a rubber dam in my mouth to make sure that none of the No particles got into my system. It was pretty amazing just the amount of hubbubaloo they went through just to make sure that there was no contamination to them. Meanwhile, I was walking around with these fillings in my mouth right next to my brain every day for about 20 years. So, and what's also interesting about it is that I did go and get I got tested for heavy metals. And actually, I have another test sitting right here where I took some DMSA, and then you basically pee in a jug for the whole day. You fill up this whole, it's about like a quart full jug of pee, and then they test your heavy metals. And lo and behold, I was tested high for mercury and also lead, interestingly enough. But so that's my experience with having the amalgams removed. And I have to, it's hard to say. I think I definitely feel better, but it hasn't been like well, I wouldn't say it was a transformation. It's been and maybe because I'm still trying to get the mercury out, right? But that's my experience with the amalgam. So it's interesting. So again, I would say, and I would echo your sentiments to make sure that you go if you're thinking about getting the amalgams removed. You see somebody who knows what they're doing. And again, just to go on the resources, you can go to drhuggins.com. Or you can go to IAOMT.org and find a dentist that really knows what they're doing before you get the amalgams taken out. Because if it's done incorrectly, you can make matters much worse, correct?
Yeah, and I was saying in the previous podcast that if they, the dentist, even if they're a biologic dentist, they might fully understand the overall safe protocol. So if they were to remove teeth in the wrong order, let's say if a couple of root canals you want to remove and they got some mercury in them, and they're removing them in the wrong order, because some are positively charged, some are negatively charged. Your mouth is a lot like the battery when you combine the metals and the saliva. You got two different types of metals sometimes. It creates galvanization. You mentioned about the mercury and the lead in your case. By the way, a lot of people have this particular interesting combination. And mercury and lead have a severe toxicity when you combine them. So you have an LD1 and an LD1, which is, one out of 100 people are going to die from lead poisoning and mercury poisoning. But you combine an LD1 and an LD1 together, mercury and lead together, it has an LD100, which means 100% of people will die. So this is just an example of how
You're making me feel so much better, Brian.
So this is an example of how toxic some of these metals can be when they're combined. And lead absolutely hates hair. So, and unfortunately, when people say, how long does it take to get rid of mercury? Well, the late Dr. Hal Huggins said, well, it takes about 35 billion years to get rid of all the mercury in your body. So now there are ways to increase the ability to get rid of mercury. The take-home message, though, is don't panic about getting rid of all the mercury and all the lead, all the arsenic, all the cadmium, what you got. Just take into consideration that your body chemistry is going to work correctly as long as you're excreting more than you are reabsorbing.
Okay, good. I like that you put a positive spin on it there. Okay, so let's shift gears. So we talked a little bit about gum disease. We discussed some of the key supplements for to making sure you have good teeth. And we talked about amalgams, and it was a little bit of a rehash of what we talked about in the earlier podcast on heavy metal toxicity. Let's completely shift gears. What about bad breath? Bad
Okay,
breath, is
great
that a
question.
problem? Is it natural? Is it an indicator of a health problem? What are your thoughts on bad breath?
Okay, so let's take this home from a male pattern baldness perspective. So it was interesting. Some time ago, there was a study that talked about the sulfur-containing gases. These were found significantly in people who tend to lose a lot of hair. And so this had to do with some sort of not just effect on hair, but things like hypertension, elevated cholesterol, and the sulfur-containing type gas that creates bad breath. They call it hydrogen sulfide. Now, it's not so much a sulfur excess per se. Hydrogen sulfide is actually a substance that governs an antioxidant system in the body. It's a discussion that goes beyond the scope of this podcast, but suffice to say, there is something wrong. So, how do you address this? Now, when you have hydrogen sulfide gases, this also affects your breath, and it might affect you systemically. And so, this is something you want to deal with. So, the problem with mouthwashes, which people often resort to, is it might disturb your nitric oxide system. Nitric oxide is that chemical, a short-term chemical gas that helps dilate your blood vessels, sort of makes things work well downstairs, and it also just is improved the relaxation of your arteries. So it's a good thing, and you don't want to destroy that. You really want to resort to addressing why the bad breath exists. So you might look at your digestive system. You might look at probiotics that might naturally help address this, that might be fermenting foods. So these are some possibilities. There's also, interestingly, sulfur added to your diet could also improve your overall digestive health. So that's something to consider. As far as your gum health, which sometimes is related to bad breath, taking things that help reduce that proton excess and electron decrease. So how do you increase the electrons and how do you decrease the protons? And you can do that by using sodium ascorbate. For example, sodium ascorbate is a sodium-based type of vitamin C that you could use as an irrigated water pick, or you could use salt, good old-fashioned sodium chloride. You can use a water pick system, and you can help essentially change the pH in your mouth and increase the electrons in your mouth, because sodium chloride is actually an electron transport system. So that's going to help reduce the chances of pockets or inflammation, gingivitis, periodontal disease, and so forth in your mouth. And if
Okay,
you do this,
and then just add on good old fashioned sodium bicarbonate, right? Just good old fashioned baking soda is another one that you're okay with.
absolutely. Yes, good old-fashioned sodium bicarbonate as well, baking soda. So if you were to irrigate yourself with one of those three things, sodium ascorbate, which is vitamin C, baking soda, as Scott just mentioned, sodium bicarbonate, or the good old-fashioned salt. It doesn't even have to be the purified stuff. It can just be good old-fashioned sodium chloride.
Okay. Well, I like that because they're low tech, low cost ways to mitigate the problem. You went through a lot there, so I just want to make sure that I understood and kind of connect the dots a little bit for folks. So, hydrogen sulfide gas, you said, a major cause of bad breath or halitosis, and also there's a it's correlated with folks that lose their hair. Did I understand that correctly? So if you have bad breath, you're likely to also be losing your hair and vice versa. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, one way of looking at it is that if you were to, say, incorporate things like fermented foods, probiotics, it could reduce or naturally reduce the levels of hydrogen sulfide gas. Think of that as sort of as a byproduct. And interestingly, by increasing your intake of sulfur or proteins that contain sulfur or sulfur-based amino acids, this can help maybe redress some halitosis issues.
Okay.
So hopefully I answered your question.
So your suggestion to mitigate bad breath is probiotics, fermented foods, sulfur-rich foods, and the sulfur amino acids, and it is not to use Listerine.
Correct. Yeah. So, because what you're happening, what is happening really is if you're using some sort of antiseptic, oral antiseptics, you're really endangering of destroying the good bacteria. You know, bacteria gets a bad rap, it always has, because people think of disease causing bacteria, but really we're more rich in health promoting bacteria. So really, you're killing off the baby in the bathwater when you're using oral antiseptics.
I want to dig into this a little bit further because I would bet that there are people out there that are health-minded people, well-informed folks that are going out of their way to buy antibiotic-free meat, that are going out of their way to buy and taking they could very well be taking probiotics, and they're aware of the kind of downstream negative health effects that come from taking antibiotics in the food and the impact on the intestinal gut flora. But who could be waking up in the morning and swishing Listerine because they
Yeah.
haven't made the connection or the understanding that there's also beneficial bacteria in the mouth, and you are essentially killing that off by swishing, Listerine and the alcohol, whatever else is in there that's basically an antiseptic, and you may want to reconsider.
Absolutely correct.
Did the did. Did the cave girl swish Listerine around, right? Was that necessary?
Exactly.
So I just wanted to kind of drill on that point because I know for a while that I did not make that connection, so I'm sure that I'm thinking there are other folks out there like me. Okay, so anything else? So we talked about gum disease, we talked about resources, we talked about some low cost options. Any other recommendations just for in general, just in a couple minutes we have left, general overall oral health that you could recommend over and above what we talked about?
Okay, so one thing I did make a little bit of mention about things like sulfur, which does help system-wide with a lot of different things in the body. And that's an important thing that also I think increases or improves oral health, not just breath, but also other things reflecting with glutathione production and so forth.
Right.
But
One
yes.
other thing, so not to interrupt you, but what about calcium? What about oral calcium? I could swear in the past you've recommended an oral calcium mouthwash from a specific site. Do you remember that? Was that calcium therapy or something? I
Oh,
don't know. Do you
right,
still
sure.
recommend that?
Sure,
I'm
that's a
going
great
up. This is back
question.
from the forum a couple of years
That's a
ago.
great
I don't
question.
remember. Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. That's a great question. So let me just preface it by saying one other thing I didn't really get into too much is magnesium, which does improve the overall regulation of calcium and absorption of calcium. Magnesium is a very important mineral. But let's get into the calcium therapy that you're referring to. I'm not referring to oral calcium. There is a website known as calciumtherapy.com. You might have to Google this, but what they do really is they have this theory that they've been employing for about 40, 45 years now. And what that is when they're using a calcium and zinc compound, it actually helps redress some infections at the root, or I should say maybe the very bottom part of an infected tooth. Usually what happens is if you look at the very root of a tooth itself, usually infections begin there in most cases. A perhaps tooth that might have a root canal, there's an infection at the root of that tooth. And this calcium zinc complex, which is a form of a safe mouthwash, if you will, a safe rinse that's composed of calcium and zinc, has a way of sort of neutralizing an infection. If you think about it, calcium's role in the body is not just to build the teeth and the bone. It's also has a root of acting as sort of a safeguard against infections. You may notice that when people go through a calcification process, it sort of helps neutralize not just heavy metals, but also neutralizes an infection such as bacteria. So calcium sort of acts as a safeguard, kind of acts as an outer shell. And so remnants of calcium is often seen in infections in the body. But in this particular case, in your teeth is not a bad place to have that calcium attached because it can help save you from a chronic infection.
Okay, got it. We didn't discuss this before the podcast, but it literally just popped in my mind about 2 minutes ago, and so I just wanted to get your take on it. So you still do recommend it. I actually did try that, but I ran out and then I never re-upped on it, but I might try it again. Okay, all right, fantastic. So well, that about does it for podcast number six. Brian, as always, thank you. Folks, if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. We really appreciate it. And then you can always visit us and read some of Brian's brilliant articles over at longevitypost.com. And then please check us out also. If you want to see my ugly mug, you can go to the YouTube channel, the Longevity Post YouTube channel, and subscribe there. And please, if you have any questions, feel free to leave those questions in the comments, and Brian and I will be glad to address them. So that about wraps it up, and we'll see you next time.